Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On Gone Medieval from History Hit, we set out to solve the biggest mysteries of the medieval age.
So many of these travellers who went out looking for Prester John, what did they think they were hearing?
Using science to identify our buried ancestors.
Genetic signatures found in present-day Ashkenazi Jewish populations were shared by the genetic ancestries we found in these individuals.
And reveal the answers to centuries-old riddles.
I stand up straight in a bed, I'm hairy at my base, and I make the ladies cry. The solution is an onion.
I'm Matt Lewis, and every Tuesday and Friday you can join me to travel the medieval world in search of the stories you haven't heard and to get under the skins of the ones you have. Gone Medieval from History Hit. Twice a week, every week. Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, and this is probably the nerdiest thing I've ever said in the world. I love the National Census. Do you remember filling it in a while ago? I certainly did mine and said that I live with my wife and my dog and had to fill in things about age and ethnicity. And I don't think I'd ever been asked before about my sexual orientation. I've filled that one in. And all that data that we shared, who we live with and everything, has been crunched by the clever people at the Office of National Statistics. And this is perfect timing because we've not only got the 2021 census, we've got the 1921 census that is just becoming available to us. All the details about that and the clever experts at the National Archive have been working on that, so I thought it'd be really smart if we could reflect on the similarities and changes that we see from the census now and 100 years ago. So I'm going to nose around that census data and find out what it says about us and indeed why it matters, because I really think it does. Melissa, my producer, is here for a chat, as usual. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Tony. So, well, you've kind of said why the census. You're a secret nerd.
Yeah. But if you think about it, it's like the census is taking a snapshot of a whole country on one day. And you've got those snapshots 10 years apart. And it's not paid for by the government or anything. It's as objective as these things can be. I think that's really wonderful for anyone interested in history, or even just if you're interested in your own area.
And tell me what area you might be interested in.
Well, I'll be interested in Hackney, because not just because it's where I was born, but my mum and dad were born there, and I can trace Hackney Robinson's back for best part of 300 years. So yeah, that'll be what I'll want to know about.
Don't forget to ask them that.
I won't. I probably will, but then you'll call me from the other side of the studio. Don't forget to ask them that. You might think that the census is something that is only for nerds. Well, you might be right if you think that, and that there isn't much to say about it. But Honestly, we all got here about 20 minutes before this podcast was due to start, and we all just sat down and have been talking to each other about the census. For those of you who don't know what it is, it happens once every 10 years. It's like a kind of snapshot of life in our country, like as though someone's taken a picture on one day in a particular year. And I'm just rifling through my notes. See how unprepared I am? Just because we've been talking all the time. John Roth-Smith from the Office of National Statistics and Jessamy Carlson from the National Archive. Am I allowed to call you Jess?
Yes, that's fine, thanks.
Great. John, can you explain in a bit more detail what the National Census is? And then I'll explain why I love it so much.
The Census, you described it really well, actually, that snapshot in time that gives us that picture. And it's, I always think that that 10-year cycle of a 10-year picture is a really nice sort of time frame for things to see change over time. But it's basically why we run a census is very much about providing local services and planning and making sure that we're making decisions as a country, both sort of in the public sector, but also in the private sector, to be able to make decisions about where services go.
But you're not bossed about by the government when you formulate this, are you?
No, 100% we aren't. So at the start of the census cycle, we consider what questions we should put on the census, and we do an engagement exercise where we ask the public and government departments and everybody who wants to participate what we should collect on the census. We've got limited space. We're not influenced by government at all. That is simply an exercise that we undertake ourselves. And we balance kind of user need and whether you can get the numbers elsewhere. Obviously, we're asking tens of millions of people these questions, so we don't have space for asking everything.
Generally, though, what kind of knowledge is it that you're after from the census?
The census is all about statistics and producing statistics. So it's not about making individual decisions about individual people. We're not allowed to do that, in fact. We're all basically about understanding local communities, national patterns, national trends. And what's great about the census, it allows us not to just consider how old people are, but consider in kind of different dimensions. So how old people are, their health, their employment, their travel to work. And it allows us to do that at a really granular level. I'm going to probably make about 15 pitches for people, listeners, to go and have a look at our census maps, because those are really exciting things that we've developed this time, where people can just get into the data, go onto our website, Census Maps, dive into the numbers and look and explore the data that they're most interested in, be it decisions about whether they want to start a new shop or just interested in their local, where they live or where they might be going to, where they're going on holiday or what have you. It's all about putting those data into the public domain so people can see that picture, the rich picture of where they live.
Jess, how long has this census stuff been going on for?
The census, as we can see it now, really has its roots in the ones that started in 1801. So between 1801 and 1831, there was a decennial census, but the data was very much kept at number level. You didn't have personal information.
What was that word, decennial? That means once every 10 years?
Once every 10 years.
Yeah.
So from 1841 onwards, we have the census that we would recognise now. It has a name, it has an address, it has a sex. And in the 1841, they first asked whether you were born in the county or outside of it. And then from 1851 until 1901, really the form, the household schedule that people are filling in or being helped to fill in pretty much looks the same between 1851 and 1901.
Why? What was it for? Did people think it was just snooping? Did they think that it was about the tax man checking that you were paying enough for your house?
So it's much harder to get a sense of that from the records that we have for England, Wales, the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, which is when I'm talking about census, that the one that I mean. Our colleagues in Scotland at National Records of Scotland are the experts on the census for Scotland, and there are also censuses for Ireland. But the reason that it's harder to tell is that because between 1841 and 1901, when we're looking at the census, we're actually looking at the enumerator's copybooks. So we're not looking at the form that your ancestor or mine filled in at home or had helped to fill in. We are looking at a collation of those records brought together and copied out by someone else. And then from 1911 and for 1921, the record we're looking at for England and Wales is the individual household schedule or the institutional schedule. And by 1921, I think there were 27 different types of form, depending on where you lived, whether you lived on a vessel or whether you lived in a house or whether you were in an institution or whether your first language was English or Welsh.
What do you mean by an institution?
A hospital, a school, boarding school, a workhouse.
So does that mean you could appear on more than one census?
The idea was that you shouldn't, that because as John mentioned, the census is a snapshot in time. It is who is in that place on that night. And in 1921, actually, it had moved. It was supposed to be April. The census is traditionally done in the spring. But in 1921, there was quite a lot of industrial unrest. And in order to stop that unrest interfering with the proper processing of the census, they moved it to June, which threw up other problems because the weather was unseasonably good on the weekend of the census in 1921, and lots of people went to the seaside. So it threw out the data, and this comes up in discussion in the Royal Statistical Society and in statistical journals in the 20s.
What, you mean that on that day, Southend was the biggest city in the whole of the United
Not
Kingdom?
Not quite, but the population was up by 64% on the previous census in Blackpool. It was up by 50% in Southend. And curiously, it was up something like 46% in Hendon. Haven't quite got to the bottom of what drove people to flock to Hendon. So it's people moving around. And actually, that's the really important thing when you're looking at the census from a historical point of view or from a genealogical perspective, is you have to remember, this isn't exactly how people live their lives through all of that time. It's where they were on one night at a moment in time.
So if it is a particularly hot day, that's really going to skew the information that you get.
And also because it's summer, you're getting things like London County Council ran lots of schemes for children who lived in poverty to help them to get fresh air, to help them to get to the seaside for a week, to get them out of those difficult circumstances they were living in. So quite a lot of those schemes are in play at that point in time because it's summer and the weather's nice. So that's the moment at which people are away, essentially.
I still haven't got a picture of why it started, what the rationale was.
It's simply government wanting to know who's in the country, where they're living, how they're living, and then it's an increasingly detailed series of questions about what those people's lives look like.
So really, this is happening at the time when the craze for recording everything is going on, isn't it? You're recording butterflies, geology, archaeology, and even how many people there are in the street.
Yeah, and that's grown over this period of time, that type of interest. And as I said, those questions become more detailed. Although actually the 1921 census is the first census where they've taken out questions. That hasn't happened before. But in the 1911 census, they'd included a new column around marital fertility, and that was taken out. And
around marital fertility,
they were
have you got fruity ovaries?
Well, they're interested in what life of the family looks like. So they're interested in infant mortality. They're interested in how many children are being born to marriages. So I knew that one of my great grandmothers was one of two children, or so we thought. She was certainly one of two surviving children, because when we looked at the 1911 census, it said number of years married, 22. Number of children born to the marriage, 8. Number of children still living, 2. And that's, we didn't know about those 6 children. I have one child. I cannot imagine having 8 children and losing 6 of them. So it's that type of interest. And then in the 1921, that column is removed. The other column, which is really key for the 1921 that has been removed, is what they call the infirmity column. So the column in which people could declare or have declared for them if they were infirm or blind or deaf. That's taken out of the 1921 census.
Now, you would have thought that people would have wanted that because they would have wanted to know, like, what kind of services those people would require.
And particularly given this point in history, it's 1921, it's 3 years since the First World War has, for the large part, ended. We've just, the contemporary society has just come out of an influenza pandemic. You would have thought that they would want to know about this, but the Royal Statistical Society was of the view that lay people could not be trusted or relied upon to impart this kind of information about themselves, and that's why it was taken out.
So many times in my career, going to parties or what have you, it's this question of why we do a census, why we have population numbers. And sometimes people's just
lack of understanding about the fact that we just don't know how many people there are. We don't record where people are. People don't just know. It's just not a known number. And it's so important, not just because of planning services, but also to be able to measure other things like rates of change. So if we unemployment rates or what have you, the denominator, the number we're dividing by, is the number of people in an area. So it's interesting for its own right, how many people there are, what sort of people there are, but also to be able to calculate things like death rates and what have you. It's really such a fundamental part of understanding society. That's one of the reasons we get so excited about it.
Well, it is, if the number of people who are filling it in is high enough.
Yes.
What sort of percentage do you get?
So we were supremely well chuffed about the response rate we got for the 2021 census. So 97% of people.
Oh my God, no, that's fantastic.
It was an incredible achievement. And I think there's something about why did people fill the form in? So we know that there was obviously, there's legislation behind the census. So that you're required to fill it in. You're liable to a fine if you don't.
What's the fine?
It's £1,000.
Ooh.
But more than that, I mean, Office of National Statistics, we take this really seriously about how much we value the data, and we want people to fill in the form, not feel the obligation to. So being able to describe to people the reasons why we're going to use the data, and not just for everybody, but also for particular communities. So that's one of the things that the census is able to do, shine a light on local area, local communities.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Mm. It's a bit like how we controlled people's behaviour during COVID. Half of it was, we really want you to do this for the good of the nation. And the other half was, however, if you don't, we'll fine you.
And I think people are increasingly concerned and aware of how their personal information is used. And actually, that's one of the things that the 1921 and the 2021 census have in common, because the 1921 census is the first census taken after the 1920 Census Act, which enshrined in law the requirement to keep that personal information, that data that identifies individuals, private, closed for 100 years. So that's the commonality between these two particular
censuses.
So
that's why we're here today talking about these two censuses that are 100 years apart, because we can talk in much more detail about the 1921, but we can talk in generalities about the 2021.
But the legislation is still the same, and it's that piece of legislation that allows the statistical work that John and his team and his colleagues are working on, because you are allowed to do that enough statistical work that doesn't allow individuals to be identified.
Yeah, and we take that incredibly seriously. I cannot overemphasise the extent to which the richness of census data is also a risk that we don't want to disclose personal information about people.
Yeah.
So we take that incredibly seriously. We've never lost census data. We've never had leaks of census data all the way back, so 200 and whatever it is years. Mm. And we take the storage of that data. When we get our census questionnaires, 2021 was different because it was predominantly online. So we still got about 2.5 million people filling in paper forms, but we destroy those paper forms. They no longer exist. So we've scanned those and those paper forms no longer exist.
Jess was telling me before we started this that twice she'd seen on the telly recently where some detective had accessed information on a recent census, which you never would in real life, isn't that right?
No, absolutely. We absolutely wouldn't, because the data that we collect is for statistical purposes, and that is not a statistical purpose to find out the whereabouts of somebody or other. And we absolutely, the legislation backs that up, and though we have been asked, we absolutely would never do that, because that's not a statistical purpose.
How do you make it that private?
So we protect the data because we compile statistics, we essentially have a really super secure environment and we control access to essentially ONS staff. And then the statistics that we produce, we go through some really rigorous process. I'm not going to go through the statistical bit of that, but we make sure that every release that we produce doesn't release any disclosive information.
Yeah.
And that is a challenge, because a little quiz question for you here. How many statistics do you think we'll produce from the 2021 census? How many numbers?
A million?
5 billion. So it's a lot of numbers, and we could produce more, but we don't do that because we don't want to disclose information about individuals, because if we did that, we'd lose that public confidence.
In the old days, how did they collect and collate the information for the census?
Individual households and institutions and vessels were given by hand at this point in time a copy of the schedule for their property. And that was given to the head of the household, or I assume whoever answered the door. But it was handed over to the household to be filled in and then collected back in. And then those forms were brought together by enumerators who were very carefully coordinated through a meticulous set of, in the 1921 example, postcards. Because we have all the sample copies at the National Archives, there's a whole book of exactly how it was enumerated. It was meticulously planned. So it's filled in a particular property. That sheet is collected and returned as part of an enumeration district. And then that is returned to the Registrar General, to the census team. And they work through those returns and start to compile statistical data. And then for the 1921, I've talked about this previously as the first big data census, because this is the first census where the information that's taken out from it, that statistical information, some of which is common with what John's working on, it's the first time that it's computed. But the
computed in the 1920s,
when they're talking about computing, they're talking about it as a sense of processing. So in this instance, the computers are actually 202 15 and 16-year-old girls who have been recruited through the local employment exchanges around Lambeth and Acton in order to populate the staff of the census team, which grows from about 50 during normal years to about 550 in a census year and the years after, as this big team comes together to process that information. And they're using tabulation, essentially punch cards.
Why would you choose, why is it gendered?
Yeah.
And why are they so young? I, to be honest, I would have thought if I'd been in charge, I would have chosen 60-year-old women, not 16-year-old women.
Well, they chose teenage girls, and the rationale was twofold. In the first instance, they thought that they were sufficiently young that they would not be afraid of new technology, which I think is probably a fair summary. They were also chosen because at 15 or 16, they're unlikely to have had bad habits drilled into them. So essentially, the census team could train them up to work within the confines of the census office in the way that they chose to. And they wouldn't come into this sort of scenario with bad habits around either processing or editing or whatever, but essentially that they could mould them into the workers they needed them to be for this purpose.
Either they knew nothing about 15-year-old girls, or they've changed enormously over the last 100 years.
Well, the school leaving age has changed quite a lot since then. Of course. So these are young women who will have been working for potentially a couple of years at this point. So I know from the names of some of the census girls, which I actually came across accidentally. So, you know, sometimes you leave a marker in a book to show where you're up to in your piece of work. They did that then. And one of the pieces of paper I realised was actually it was a nomination form for the Civil Service Sports and Social Club for the Registrar General's team. And they were looking for nominees from the census girls, as they called them, to be part of that Civil Service Sports and Social Club. And it has the names of the nominees on the back. And a couple of them had quite unusual surnames. So knowing that they're probably younger than 20, I could then go and look at the 1921 census and go, aha, you're here. So I could see that a couple of them had worked for the Ministry of Pensions before they'd come to the census team. So you can kind of see those young women moving around.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because we had working with colleagues in Republic of Ireland, and they were at a different stage to us with their census development. And they had to take the decision to not do an online census. It was all paper. And as part of that, they said, try to turn that into a positive, and came up with the idea of this. It was a time capsule idea. So actually on the paper questionnaire, there was a blank box at the end, and it was said, leave a message for future generations. So in 100 years time, people can look at what you, and obviously the data will be protected for 100 years, and you can write in whatever you want. And you can imagine probably what some people wrote in. But talking to colleagues over there, people were doing pictures and writing songs and writing messages, as well as some perhaps more unsavoury things. But obviously it was, you know, people weren't going to look at that for 100 years. And then the idea of colleagues coming to that and being able to see that, family historians, it was a fascinating idea, a really lovely idea.
That's such an inspired idea, actually, isn't it? That you would actually be able to get a snapshot of culture through doing that, and you'd know where it was. I was involved in an awful lot of those millennial caches of treasure and stuff that schools buried in the ground. Within 5 years, no one knew where they were. they tried to invite me back to redig a few of them. No one could remember. But one of the great things, I think, about the census is it's so kind of chunky. We're not going to lose it, are we?
We're absolutely not going to lose it. I can guarantee you of that.
Although, having said that, didn't one catch fire?
Yes. So there's actually a gap in censuses in England and Wales between 1921, which has now been released, and there now won't be a census released until the 1951 census comes out. Because the 1931 census was taken, it was analysed, the statistical reporting for it was done, and then it was transferred to the Ministry of Works store at Hayes, which went up in smoke in the 1940s due to a carelessly discarded cigarette.
We all pulled that face. Let that be a lesson to you.
The 1941 census wasn't taken because we were at war, so the next census that's going to be released is the 1951 census, and I have the horrible realisation that I'm still going to be working when that comes out.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, and my special guests this week, the data whizzes Jessamy Carlson and John Rothsmith. John, I haven't asked you how technically the last census was created.
It was a really nerve-wracking thing to think on that census day there's going to be this huge spike of people who are going online and completing the form. So it was nerve-wracking to think, is the system going to take it? And we hear a lot about government IT infrastructure projects when they go wrong. You don't hear anything about them when they go well. But actually, our system stood up incredibly well. Everybody got online. There weren't any service disruption issues. And millions of people went on that online on that day and filled in the form, which
was
incredible.
It must have been incredibly exciting for you on that day. Paint me a picture of your office. How many people were
in
there?
So the office was completely empty. There was nobody in at all. The whole thing was done online. So obviously at the time it was during the lockdown, so we were all working from home. We were joining sort of online calls every day. There was a sense of incredible excitement and anticipation, but also that overwhelming dread that something would go wrong and we'd be in trouble. Over the past 10 years, there have been instances of where censuses haven't gone very well.
What, in other countries?
Yeah, so in New Zealand and to a certain extent Australia, things have not gone as expected, and the response rate had been much lower. We put a huge amount of effort into making sure that system was as easy as possible to fill in. Another quiz question for you. Of the people who filled in the census online, what percentage of people filled it on a mobile phone?
I'm going to say 30%.
Yes. I'm going to go for 45.
So it's 56%.
Wow.
Which is an incredible achievement. And the idea of being able to do that and it being easy, we had one of my favourite features with this kind of Welsh toggle you could do, so toggle between the Welsh form and the English form. That ability to make it as easy as possible for people to complete. I mean, the world was a very different place in 1921. Filling in forms and what have you and going online and filling in forms, people do that on a regular basis. But perhaps their patience for things wasn't as great as it was back then. So we were very conscious that we had to make it as easy as possible for people. We would love to ask 5,000 questions on everything about the set, you know, every characteristic in the country, pets or what have you, pets. But we knew that burden was really important to people, and we wanted people to fill in all the questions that we wanted to ask. So we did limit the number of questions.
As we've raised the pets issue, you said that in the 1921 census, some people put in their pets?
There were. I was actually looking back at this for previous censuses too, and there was a gentleman in the 1911 who justified including his cat on the basis that the cat ate at the same table and slept in the same rooms as all of the human children, so why should the cat not be included? Fair enough. But yes, there are a variety of animals that crop up, and actually our colleagues at Find My Past have done this brilliant Google map where you can see where all the animals and birds and indeed insects are enumerated around the country. So there were cats, there were dogs, there were beetles in Swindon. There was a gentleman called Frank Williams who was a dairy manager living on the Commercial Road. And at the bottom of his census form, he wrote, "I own one dog, no cats nor like items, but beetles are here by the thousand." There are ferrets in Splott. There are canaries in Bristol. Plenty of cats in North London. There was a cat called Ginger in Stratford. There was a rat in the Newman household, which is sort of, they were down in Vauxhall, I think it was. Yeah, a cat called Tarzan in Stoke Newington, and a cat called Ginger in Stratford. But yeah, various people very much seeing those animals as part of the family, or possibly just testing the limits of the census form.
Right, the pet bit is in parenthesis. What I really want to ask you about is the story that the press picked up about the most recent census, which was sexual orientation.
Yeah, so we had, I talked earlier about the new questions that we introduced, and there were three really. So the one about sexual orientation, one about gender identity, and also one about veterans. So if you previously served as part of the UK Armed Forces, all those subjects we were incredibly proud to be able to collect statistics on. And we did that because there weren't reliable statistics from other places. Sexual orientation question was new. We found 43.4 million people were straight or heterosexual, and 1.5 million people, 3.2% of the population, were LGB plus. And it's been fascinating, the interest.
You said LGB plus. You didn't do a thing on trans people.
So that was part of the gender identity question, which is a different question. But it was amazing the way that the release of those numbers has really resonated with that community. So I talked earlier about the census maps that are available. So people could explore, see pictures of their local area, and to be able to see those numbers. And actually, people had printed out posters of their local area to show the statistics of where there were populations of LGB plus, printing out T-shirts and what have you. I never thought people would do that with our statistics, but it just demonstrated how that resonated with
people. That's great. It's not what I would have expected. I would have thought that people would have said, mind your own business, but they're going, we live in Brighton and we've got loads of gay people here.
I think part of it is about, I mean, the census has always been about self-identification of communities. Yeah. So,
and representation.
And representation. So the Cornish population, for example, identifying how big the size of that community actually is.
Sorry, what did you mean when you said "and representation" very seriously?
I just think being able to see yourself in public documentation is really important for people, to be able to recognise people who are like you, who you identify with, whether that's contemporary or historic. I think it's really important. I think it's one of the most powerful things we do at National Archives when we work with, particularly with school children, is to be able to show them people like them in the past, to be able to show them that whilst their circumstances are obviously unique to them, but they're not necessarily the only people who've lived through times like this, circumstances like this, in places like them.
Was there any way in the older censuses whereby people could express a bit more of themselves than simply that they lived in a house?
Yes. So this is an opportunity for people to speak to government, and they took it. So we don't see it quite as much in the 1921 as we have, for example, in the 1911 census. So the 1911 census was quite dominated by protests around women's rights. So you see women particularly writing about, you know, no vote, no census. Mary Hare, who was the headmistress of a school for deaf children in the south of England, she made sure she wasn't at home on the night of the census. And then if you look at her form, it shows that the enumerator went round to try and get information about her and noted that she had purposefully evaded it on the grounds of her political beliefs. Now, by 1921, the situation has changed. The Representation of the People Act has been passed. Some women and more men have the vote now. So that type of protest has rapidly diminished. In 1921, people were more likely to be protesting their own personal circumstances from people who are very angry about the situation in which they find themselves living. So you have people talking about what's going on in their lives and how they feel they're not supported by the government and how upset and let down and betrayed they feel about this, through to people who just say, you know, there's one gentleman who wrote, "Times are hard, please help us." Wow. And it's really poignant.
Yeah.
And then you have people who have, frankly, quite ranty responses. So you get people who have filled in every single space on the form because they have something they wish to say to government and this is their opportunity and they are taking it. So you have people who've written quite lengthy diatribes about their views on society and politics and government at this point in time. And
but nothing about sexual orientation?
It's not a question that's asked explicitly at this point, but that's not to say that we don't see people who are in same-sex relationships or who might identify as gay or lesbian or trans in the census, because those people are there. In 1921, homosexuality is illegal, which makes it a very different space to be publicly declaring yourself. However, we do still see people essentially telling us that, you know, they are living in those relationships. We see quite a lot of joint head of household or co-head of household appearing amongst people that we know to have been in same-sex relationships, and then running a keyword search on that, going, okay, so we know these people who we know to be gay or lesbian or trans, identifying themselves in this way. Okay, so are there other people?
Yeah.
And my colleague Vicky has blogged about this brilliantly, and you can look at that in the National Archives blog, and she talks about this at length. But we start to see other groups of people positioning themselves, identifying in that same way, and particularly around that co-head of household, that idea that they're actually, it's not so much as expressing their sexuality, but they're expressing their equality
their
in the household.
Within a relationship. Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that's really
Isn't
interesting.
That interesting, because so often we're governed by where we are now, and we think that the ideas that we have and the attitudes that we have are just contemporary. But the idea that in 1921, two women would say, "We are both in charge of this household,"
yeah,
is kind of moving, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about the king? Did the king fill in the census?
Twice in 1921, except it wasn't actually him, it was the master of the household. So as I mentioned earlier, there were 27 types of census form for the 1921 census, mostly in English but also some in Welsh. One of the options is an E form, so that's the standard household schedule for England in English, and there is one of those for the royal household, for the immediate royal family, filled in by the master of the household. And we can see that because on the flip side of the 21 census you have the form and it has all the information about the family. And on the other side, it tells you who filled the form in. And there's also a signature. So we know who's filling it in for Windsor Castle. So we have an E form for Windsor Castle for 1921. And then we have an III form, which is the largest type of institutional form. And I think it has 209 people listed on it for the broader population of Windsor Castle. And the king is also on that. So for the 1921, the king turns up twice.
John, what about migration? I mean, that's like a real big issue for a lot of people nowadays. And yet we only do a snapshot of one day. Can you capture a sense of what people's movements throughout the country are?
The census is an incredible thing, but there's some things that it's not amazing at in terms of migration patterns over time, that the sort of ebb and flow of those migration patterns. And we do surveys on an ongoing basis, and we use other data sources to measure flows of migration. The thing that the census is quite magical about is its ability to look over time by asking that question on country of birth, to say the stocktake of the population as it is today, where were people born? And you can see previous migration trends in that country of birth profile. So when we ran a census 10 or 20 years ago, we saw far fewer people from Romania. And we know with changes with the EU since the 2011 census, there has been a significant increase in the number of people from Romania. So, for example, in 2001, Romanian was the 86th most common country of birth, and it's now the fourth. It's gone from 80,000 people born in Romania in 2011 to over 500,000 people born in Romania. We can also see population of people from Poland, so EU expansion prior to the last census. And then we can also see the kind of a longer term migration pattern. So you can see people who were born in Jamaica, for example. And we can see how that profile's changed in terms of the people born in the UK. So in the 2001 census, Jamaica was the sixth most common country of birth, and now it's down to the 20th most common country of birth. You can also see India is the most common country of birth, and Ireland in 2001 it was the most common country of birth, and now it's down to fifth. So we can see that change over time. What I think is really interesting about this census is that we don't just collect that as a concept. We have this range of different concepts like country of birth, national identity, whether you regard yourself as British, language spoken, because we know these concepts are quite complex and they're interrelated in terms of how they operate. We collect these statistics, but we know that other people will do research on these numbers to be able to get that sort of deeper insight.
Do lots of other countries have national censuses, and are we really good at it?
We are really good. We are really good. I would say that. So 97% response rate is absolutely Premier League in terms of response rates. The Canadians tend to be really good, annoyingly good, but they do one every 5 years, so they get more practice. The Americans, the US Census Bureau undertake a census, as do Australia, and there are many other countries in the world that undertake them. Countries in Europe are a sort of mix of approaches. So in some countries, particularly in Scandinavia, they have something called a population register. So you're required to tell the government by law about when you move. We don't have that system in the UK. There's growing kind of desire to move to using administrative data, so other government data that's collected, to be able to produce these types of statistics more often. ONS has an aspiration to be able to do that as well. We get super excited about census data. To be able to do that on a more regular basis would be absolutely incredible. One of the issues with the census is it's amazing for now, but that 10-year gap when it comes to policy making, decision making, we need those numbers to be as up to date as possible. So we've got that aspiration to move into that kind of model.
Is the census vulnerable? You know, given the financial crises that we've had over the last 5 or 6 years, anything that is anything to do with the state apparatus, there are going to be MPs who say, let's get rid of this thing.
What's not vulnerable is the idea of being able to produce census type statistics. So I think it's very widely recognised that understanding the society and the economy is absolutely fundamental to any modern democracy. It's absolutely critical. We do take that burden on the public really seriously, and we want to be able to be responsive to government and the public to be able to measure the population. The census, a traditional census, may not be the best way to do that. We're making a recommendation to Parliament by the end of this year about what that statistical system looks like for population and migration statistics. So I don't think it's vulnerable in the sense of being able to create these types of statistics, being able to create this insight. We may change how we the model for that we use, moving away from a traditional census. Perhaps we may stick to doing it like that. Many other countries in the world are looking at similar sorts of approaches.
I would make a plea, A, that whatever you suggest to government, it remains independent, because to me that 100%. Is the great beauty of it. It's not like the Doomsday Book, which is wonderful, but actually it was about people going looking for taxes, and the Anglo-Saxons did one called the Burgelheide, didn't they, which is the same thing, but it is so kind of skewed. The great thing is the democratic feel of it, and I love the idea of having a little space where you can just say what you like. I think it was
absolutely
brilliant.
We work really hard to be able to demonstrate the numbers are completely independently produced, and we've got really robust methods behind them, and the quality of the statistics is absolutely up there.
Some favourite things, Jesse. I know you've come in with
you've got lists
with some.
Oh, Jesse's going outdo me.
I'll ask you your top three.
I mean, I've already alluded to the.
Sorry, I've just spilt my coffee over the lap. So you carry on while I mop up.
One of the sweetest things I actually found was with newborn babies, obviously. Hundreds of babies are born every day. And there was one we were looking at, actually, for one of my colleagues, where we were looking at one of his great-grandparents, and he knew that his great-grandfather's birthday was Census Day, and sure enough, if you look at the census form, it says baby boy, and then in the age column, which was years and months for 1921, it just says baby born today. And that's quite sweet. I really like the census girls. I think the idea of those 202 teenage girls brought in and their role in this is just, from a sociological point of view as well as a historical one, absolutely fascinating. I'd love to find out more about them, but unfortunately they didn't keep the staff lists, so trying to piece them together is quite tricky.
John, have you got any favourite things?
The 2021 census was the first where we found more people aged over 65 than aged under 16. Mm. There were more old people than there were younger people.
That's a really important statistic.
It's absolutely critical. And I think it's really important to be able to say, it's an interesting statistic in your own right, but it also makes you stop and think, and you think that's an ageing population, and that's obviously what we've got in England and Wales, but it kind of brings it to life about what that means. So that's one of my favourite statistics. That's quite a serious one. I talked about running a digital census. We made really, really clear that if anybody ever wanted a paper questionnaire, we would make one available to them. But by getting essentially 89% of households who completed the census form did it online, we saved, we think, about 450 million pieces of paper, which is it's a big number, not as big as my 5 billion census statistics, but it's a huge, huge amount of, and this day and age, that's really important. My third is probably, you remember maybe Jedis in the 2001 census.
Oh, so, from Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, for people putting their religion as Jedi.
There was a campaign, wasn't
there? Was a campaign. It was a lot of fun. So 390,000 people put Jedi in 2001.
As the job?
No, as the religion.
Oh, the religion.
And we see, it's not the return of the Jedi, it's more the demise of the Jedi, or as others have phrased it, Jexit. 2021, 1,600 people put Jedi as the religion, despite the Disney franchise. So yeah, so that's one of the really significant changes, and that's obviously in the context of religion as being one of the big stories from the census. In this census, there was a decrease in the number of proportion of people and the number of people who put themselves down as Christian, quite a significant change. Yeah. So it went from 33 million to 27.5 million, which is a real sizable change, yeah, in how people define themselves. In terms of a societal change, it's a really, really fascinating insight.
Have you done any work on my antecedents? In other words, Hackney, where I was born and my mum and dad were born.
So I thought it'd be interesting to see how well you knew Hackney now in 2021. So in terms of the average age of England and Wales, is, or median age, but basically average, was 40. Hackney in 2021, is that younger or older?
Younger, definitely younger. Mm. All those young people
hip
moving
people.
Into, yeah.
Hip people. So it's now 32.
I was going to say that.
Oh, sorry.
Honest.
I was very intrigued because when I went looking for statistics on Hackney, Hackney's actually quite mid-table for London boroughs. It's neither, you know, kind of in the great heights or in the great depths in terms of most of the statistical fields that the 1921 looked at. The one where it stood out was it was one of the boroughs with the fewest number of flats in London. So only 9% of buildings in Hackney in the 1921 census were flats.
That's interesting. I wonder whether it's because there were so many of those little Victorian houses.
I think so, because 82% of the housing stock in Hackney were individual residences. It was 9% above shops and factories, 9% flats, and 82% kind of domestic residences, yeah, like that. But that was amongst the lowest in London. So Woolwich had the lowest. That was 4%.
Looking forward, what is your cunning plan for the census?
So I think the cunning plan has got to be, for this census, the 2021 census, exactly how we make the most out of the data. So we know that we're able to produce statistics, but if we don't get those statistics into the hands of the people who make decisions, then it's all a bit of a, that we haven't recognised that full value. When we're talking about where we put schools and hospitals and all the rest of it, there can be a plan no more cunning than that, can there? Mm. That's the most important thing. So it's not really about us as statistics office, it's about the people who make those decisions, so getting those numbers into the hands so that the cunningness of cunning plans can be realised.
So for me, as an archivist and a historian, the census is a gateway. It's a way of piquing someone's interest and going, here is a place or a person or a community that matters to you, that makes you want to find out more and makes you feel like archives are a space you are able to be, are entitled, are allowed to be in. And giving people the confidence to step foot into that world and start to try and find things that I say just pique their interest. And there's nothing better as someone who works in National Archives to be in the reading room. And I can only describe it as a squeak. There is a very particular squeak that you hear just out of the corner, you know, you just glance it when someone has found something that they're really excited about and they don't quite know what to do with it. And you just hear this little squeak because they've seen something on the screen that's made them go, wow, or that's my family, or that's my house. Everyone has the right to be looking at this material, to be understanding, to getting something from it.
For people who want to know more about anything really census related, whether John's contemporary stuff or Jess's older stuff, what do they do? How do they find out?
I advise people just Googling census maps as being a really nice product to be able to have a play with census data.
And where do you find the census maps?
It's on the ONS website. Yeah. You can just Google census maps and it will be one of the top searches. And it enables you to look at an incredible level of detail, even down to neighbourhood level, all those dimensions of the census data. But it really brings it home. And you can literally play for hours by just exploring your area, where you went on holiday last year, where you grew up, where you went to university, where your mum and dad, all those things, just to be able to get a feel for an area. It's just absolutely fascinating.
And if it's the historic census that you're interested in, the National Archives has research guides on our website, nationalarchives.gov.uk. You can look at the research guides of the census, which has a really lengthy history of everything you might need to know. The great power of an archive is that everyone is welcome. Anyone can come to the National Archives and look at the census, whether you're 6 or 60, you know, everyone is welcome.
Thank you ever so much, both of you, John Rowe-Smith, Jess Carlson. I hope we've managed to turn a few more people on to the glory that is the National Census. And just one little plug for the Office of National Statistics and the National Archive. They're names which kind of drift past most people's consciousness, but they both hold within them our history, our communities, our culture. And don't forget, if you want a really good squeak, go to the National Archive. Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on Twitter at @Tony_Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on Twitter and Instagram at @CunningcastPod. And please, please, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss an episode. I'm Tony Robinson. This is my Cunning Cast, produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.